Recently, there was a news report on mainstream TV that talked about weather change and a new report out of Princeton University, but they didn't tell you the real story. The meteorologist interviewed just said, repeatedly, we can't predict the weather.
Freedom of the press is only guaranteed when you own the press.
It's time to hear the other side of the news.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message, wake up. Every station is a gentrification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. But do we even know who plants the seeds? You think the media works for you, but it's a job for them. They're just selling fruit.
The other side of the news.
Ignorance grows on the spirit like a tumor.
Till freedom is a rumor.
Princeton's study actually tells you why we can't predict the weather. And here is the full release. You're not getting all the news from mainstream media. Princeton University researchers recently reported in the Journal of Climate that extremely sunny or cloudy days are more common than in the early 1980s, and that swings from thunderstorms to dry days rose considerably since the late 1990s. These swings could have consequences for ecosystem stability and the control of pests and diseases, as well as for the industries such as agriculture and solar energy production, all of which are vulnerable to inconsistent and extreme weather. The day-to-day variations could also affect what scientists could expect to see as the Earth's climate changes. According to the researchers and other scientists familiar with the work, constant fluctuations in severe conditions could alter how the atmosphere distributes heat and rainfall, as well as inhibit the ability of plants to remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, possibly leading to higher levels of the greenhouse gas than currently accounted for. Existing climate change models have historically been evaluated against the average weather per month, an approach that hides variability, explained the lead author, Dave Madavi, an assistant professor to the Department of Geosciences at Princeton. To conduct their analysis, he and co-author Claude Bellou, a postdoctoral research fellow in Princeton's program in atmospheric and oceanic sciences, used a recently developed computer program that has allowed climatologists to examine weather data on a daily level for the first time. Monthly averages reflect a misty world that is a little rainy and cloudy every day. That is very different from the weather of our actual world, where some days are very sunny and dry. The work adds to what we know about climate change in the real world and places the whole problem of climate change in a new light. Nobody has looked for these daily changes on a global scale. They usually think of climate change as an increase in mean global temperature and potentiality. More extreme conditions. There's practically no discussion of a day-to-day variability. The Princeton findings stress that analysis of erratic daily conditions, such as frequent thunderstorms, may, in fact, be crucial to truly understanding the factors shaping climate and affecting the atmosphere, said William Russo. He's a professor of Earth Systems Science and Environmental Engineering at the City College of New York. From 1997 to 2007, rainfall became highly erratic for much of the globe, particularly in the tropical areas. Green areas indicate that the day-to-day variability increased so that those areas experience more days at one extreme or another, either dry or a downpour, with little weather variation in between. It's important to know what the daily extremes might do because we might care about that sooner. Russo has also studied weather variability. Russo says existing climate change models show light rain more frequently than they should and don't show extreme precipitation. If it rains a little bit every day, the atmosphere may respond differently than if there's a really big rainstorm once a week. One of the things you find about rainstorms is that the really extreme ones are at a scale that the atmosphere responds to. Although climate change models predict future changes in weather as the planet warms, those calculations are hindered by a lack of representation of the day-to-day patterns. We are at a stage where we had better take a look at what this research is pointing out. Madavi and Bellou determined sunshine variation by analyzing fluctuations in solar radiation, captured by the International Satellite Cloud Climatology Project. from the years 1984 to 2007. To gauge precipitation, the researchers used daily rainfall data from the Global Precipitation Climatology Project spanning from 1997 to 2007. Madhavi and Bailu found that during those respective periods, extremes in sunshine and rainfall became more common on a day-to-day basis. In hypothetical terms, Madhavi said, these findings would mean that a region that experienced the greatest increase in sunshine variability might have had partly cloudy skies and conditions every day in 1984, but in 2007, the days would have been either sunny or heavily clouded with nothing in between. For rainfall, the uptake and variation he and Bailu observed could be thought of as an area experiencing a light mist every day in 1997. But within 10 years, the days became increasingly fluctuated between dryness and downpour. The researchers observed at least some increase in variability for 35% of the world during the time periods analyzed. Regions such as equatorial Africa and Asia experienced the greatest increase in the frequency of extreme conditions, with erratic shifts in weather occurring throughout the year. In more temperate regions such as the United States, day-to-day variability increased to a lesser degree and typically only seasonally. In the northeastern United States, for instance, sudden jumps from a sunny to a bleak day became more common during the winter from 1984 to 2007. In the 23 years that sunshine variably rose for tropical Africa and Asia, those areas also showed a greater occurrence of towering thunderstorms known as convective clouds. Tropical areas that experienced more and more unbalanced levels of sunshine and rainfall witnessed an in-kind jump in convective cloud cover. Although the relationship between those clouds and weather variations needs more study, Madhavi said the findings could indicate that the sunnier days accelerate the rate at which water evaporates, then condenses in the atmosphere to form rain, thus producing heavy rain more often, and we've seen that a lot these past few years. An important point here is storms have a lasting effect on daily weather patterns. There is a residual factor. Although the most extreme weather variations in the study were observed at the tropics, spurts of extreme weather are global in reach. The atmosphere is a fluid, and when severe weather, such as convective cloud thunderstorm, punches it, the disturbance spreads around the world. Weather that increasingly leaps from one extreme condition to another in just a short period of time affects the equilibrium of heat and rain worldwide. Storms are violent and significant events. While they are individually localized, their disturbance radiates all over the world. Wherever it's raining heavily, especially or variably, is where the atmosphere is being punched. As soon as it is punched somewhere in the tropics, it starts waves that go all the way around the planet. So we can see waves coming off the West Pacific, convection activity, and going all the way around the planet in the tropical band. The atmosphere also has the job of moving heat from the equator to the poles, and storms are the source of heat to the atmosphere. So if a storm's location or its timing or its seasonality is altered, that's going to change how the circulation responds. These sweeping atmospheric changes can interact with local conditions, such as the temperature and topography, to skew regular weather patterns. Signals end up going all over the globe, but you can think of storms as being the disturbances in an otherwise smooth flow. That's why this is a climate issue, even though we're talking about daily variations and variability in specific locations. The impact of these fluctuations on natural and man-made systems could be as substantial as the fallout predicted from rises in the Earth's average temperature. Inconsistent sunshine could impair the effectiveness of solar energy production, and with fluctuating rainfall also included, harm agriculture. Wetter, hotter conditions also breed disease and parasites, such as mosquitoes, particularly in the tropic areas. Wild shifts in day-to-day conditions could diminish the ability of trees and plants to remove carbon from the atmosphere. Erratic rain and sunlight impair photosynthesis. Think about that. This effect upsets the structure of ecosystems, as certain plants and trees, particularly broadleaf trees, more than conifers, adapt more than others. The impact of variability on photosynthesis could mean that more carbon will remain in the atmosphere than climate models currently anticipate, considering that the models factor in a normal S plant-based carbon absorption. These fluctuations could become self-perpetuating by increasingly trapping the gases that agitate weather patterns in the first place. He said, we have not yet looked for the direct ties between weather variability and increased carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere. But I would not be surprised if they are now connected in some way. All of a sudden, the land and the atmosphere are no longer in balance, and plants can't absorb carbon dioxide proportional to the concentrations in the environment, and that's going to affect everybody. You can find the report for yourself by going to Princeton University Journal of Climate. They occupy this project. It's going on all over the world. There's a lot of video on YouTube, and one of the better ones I've posted on my Facebook page. It shows a mix of what Hillary Clinton and Obama are saying when it comes to the fights and wars to uproost a tainted power in the Far East. But it seems to ignore the same values right here in its own country. United States, and of course that means Canada as well. So far, last count, 951 cities were doing the Occupy This movement, and 82 countries, and I'm sure there's more than that by the time this news is getting out. Here is a bit of a report from Chuck Collins talking about the reasons why people are out in the streets.
Morning, everybody. My name is Chuck Collins. I'm a senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies, and I'm a co-editor of the web portal inequality.org. There you'll find a sort of commentary and data and chart packs and some of the information that's behind some the conversation that we're having this morning. We have two terrific able resources with us this morning, Heidi Hartman from the Institute for Women's Policy Research and U.S. Representative Jan Schakowsky representing the 9th District of Illinois, one of the best advocates we have on Capitol Hill on these issues of fairness and equity. I'm going to set a bit of context and then turn it over to our two other speakers. But my assumption is that you came not because you need to be convinced that the growing concentration of wealth is a problem or that you don't sort of have the basic picture, assuming you're sort of interested in what its implications are and what we can do about it. I can say personally, when I was a young tenant organizer, community organizer in the early 90s, I saw these inequality trends start to emerge in the lives of the people I was working with. You could see what it meant for people's wages to be stagnant or actually falling and how people were working more hours just to sort of hold it together. And at that time, a former speechwriter for Richard Nixon, Kevin Phillips, wrote a book called The Politics of Rich and Poor, which was really interesting. I remember reading that and thinking, wow, you know, the whole 80s was a time of accelerating inequality. Why aren't we talking more about this? And at that time, 1995, I remember that we were sort of having what I would call kind of a debate over the statistics, whether these inequalities were really happening. But by 2000, that was over. I mean, Alan Greenspan, George W. Bush, The Wall Street Journal were doing articles specifically looking at the issues of income inequality. What happened then, I think, was that the debate went to, does it matter? Does it matter how wealthy the wealthy are? Does it matter? Poverty is a problem, and we should be focused on that. But does it matter how the concentrated wealth is a problem. So that's where the debate is. And I think what I'll do is very briefly just show you some of the picture that I think some of you know. And if you're interested in more of this data, I'll just mention there's inequality.org and the other 98% as kind of an organizing arm, two projects where you can actually get this data and download it. What I would first say is that we're living in a period of extreme inequality. We as a country have been there before, and what you see is the concentration of income at the beginning of the century, the percentage of the income owned by the top 1%. That was 1928, was the zenith of income inequality, and now at the end of the graph you can see the present era. So we are in a second phase of extreme inequality. And that in the years in the middle, from the post-World War II to the mid-70s was a period of relatively shared prosperity. The rising tide more or less lifted all boats. In this case, every fifth of the society saw their real incomes almost double. Whereas the last period, since the late 70s, what Paul Krugman calls the staircase graph, shows that at the bottom, real incomes for the bottom fifth have gone down, and incomes breaking out at the top. So that's income, but wealth is also concentrated and pooled. The richest 1% have over 36%, almost 36% of all private wealth. And that same richest 1% has about 80% of all financial assets, stocks and bonds, and financial wealth. And prior to the economic meltdown, the richest 1% owned or controlled about $20 trillion, which is an important number that I will come back to, because that's a huge amount of wealth that was, a lot of it was invested in the casino economy, the speculative economy, and that's one of the things that I think contributed to the economic instability we're living through. The national budget is, what, $3 trillion or something, I think, of income inequality. And now, at the end of the graph, you can see the present era. So we are in a second phase of extreme inequality. And that in the years in the middle, from the post-World War II to the mid-70s, was a period of relatively shared prosperity. The rising tide more or less lifted all boats. In this case, every fifth of the society saw their real incomes almost double, whereas the last period since the late 70s, at the bottom on the left side, real incomes for the bottom fifth have gone down, and wealth is also concentrated and pooled. The richest 1% have over 36%, almost 36% of all private wealth. And that same richest 1% has about 80% of all financial assets, stocks and bonds, and financial wealth. And prior to the economic meltdown, the richest 1% owned or controlled about $20 trillion, which is an important number that I will come back to, because that's a huge amount of wealth that was, a lot of it was invested in the casino economy, the speculative economy. And that's one of the things that I think contributed to the economic instability we're living through. $55 to $60 trillion of wealth, all the speedboats, houses, land, securities, all the privately owned wealth, and that a third of that is owned by this richest 1%. What's happened in terms of racial wealth disparities, meaning that the net worth, the median net worth of an African-American household is about a little over $5,000. The median net worth of a white household is about $113,000. That's after the economic meltdown, when everybody saw particularly their home values lose value, but Latinos and African Americans lost much more of a percentage of their net worth as a result of the economic meltdown. On the question of meaning, these statistics, the title of this panel is Concentrated Wealth, Bad for Your Health, Bad for Democracy. And I would argue that these inequalities that we're living through are bad for democracy, bad for the economy, bad for your health, bad for the culture, bad for all the things that we care about, really, that these extreme inequalities are undermining all that makes our lives healthy and viable. On the question of democracy, again, back in the last Gilded Age, Louis Brandeis, before he was a Supreme Court justice, famously said, you can have concentrated wealth in the hands of a few, or you can have democracy, but you cannot have both.
The people of the Middle East, like people everywhere, are seeking a chance to contribute and to have a role in the decisions that will shape their lives. Leaders need to respond to these aspirations and to help build that better future for all. They need to view civil society as their partner, not as a threat.
And 100 years ago, there was a much more robust debate about what these inequalities mean and what does it mean for democracy. And people were living through what they called a plutocracy, the corporate capture of the democracy by the robber barons, by the huge corporations and trusts.
I want to take this opportunity to update the American people about the situation in Libya. Protesters took to the streets across the country to demand their universal rights and a government that is accountable to them and responsive to their aspirations. But they were met with an iron fist.
Well, here we are. We're back. Obviously, huge influence on our democratic system, both the electoral system and the influence of the rule-writing process and the capture of our democratic system by big money. But it's also had a huge impact on the economy. Bob Reich writes about this in his book Aftershock. When you have stagnant wages for half the population, or falling wages, people survive by borrowing more and working more hours. So, bam, when the economic meltdown comes in 2008, all that borrowing contributes to instability.
The people of the Middle East, like people everywhere, are seeking a chance to contribute and to have a role in the decisions that will shape their lives. Leaders need to respond to these aspirations and to help build that better future for all. They need to view civil society as their partner, not as a threat.
I want to take this opportunity to update the American people about the situation in Libya. Last month, protesters took to the streets across the country to demand their universal rights and a government that is accountable to them and responsive to their aspirations. But they were met with an iron fist.
Freedom of assembly, freedom of expression, and freedom of the press.
Come here. You want to get arrested or no?
Are pillars of an open and inclusive society.
For months, the Iranian people have sought nothing more than to exercise their universal rights. We call upon the Iranian government to abide by the international obligations that it has to respect the rights of its own people. Innocent civilians were imprisoned.
I have not been read my rights. I have not been told I am being detained.
We want to know the people who are in there. We want to know all their names, what they're being charged with.
And in some cases, beaten.
I can't breathe, officer. Please get off his neck.
I need my inhalant.
A campaign of intimidation and repression began.
Is the responsibility of the government of Libya to respect the universal rights of their own people, including their right to free expression and assembly.
What's his badge number? What is his badge number?
Demonstrators have been beaten. Attacked.
What is absolutely clear is that we are witnessing history unfold.
But you also have this huge concentration of wealth among that 1% and even in that top 0.1%. And those people are going to their investment advisors who are saying, you know, you can keep your investments in General Electric and the stock market and those boring blue chip stocks, but if you come in this door over here marked casino, there's a lot more interesting stuff going on, and you can get 20% returns for 5 years running. So huge amounts of that wealth moving into the speculative aspect of the economy and also destabilizing it. Finally, these economic instabilities, these inequalities have a huge impact on health. Some of you may know this book, Spirit Level, and if you don't, I highly recommend it. And actually, the author, Richard Wilkinson, he's a British doctor who looked at the issues of inequality and how it affects health. But his conclusion actually is it affects everything, that these inequalities lead to a breakdown in social solidarity, a sense that we're in the same boat, a sense that our destinies are intertwined and therefore lead to all kinds of distortions in the culture. So his whole argument is we need to reduce these inequalities to get back to any kind of decent society, and that they has huge moral, psychological, spiritual, and obviously economic impacts on our lives. That this is shifting. Public opinion on inequality is dramatically shifting. When I started doing this work, polls showed we had a very high tolerance in our society for inequality. Most people said, I don't really care about these inequalities as long as there's mobility, opportunity for me to be wealthy, and that the game is fair. What's happened in the last 2 years is that shifted. Now people say inequality is a huge problem. Why? Because mobility has stalled out, because the middle class is under attack, and because they see the game is rigged, that the richest 1% and these a sector of the global corporate class have rigged the game. They've used their power to rewrite the rules and rig the game in their favor. So I want to steer you, and we'll talk more about this. There's some interesting and inspiring efforts out there. There's an effort called Wealth for the Common Good, which is actually wealthy individuals who care about these inequalities. Alison Goldberg is here, who's the director of that project. And she and others have started something called the Patriotic Millionaires, which has brought together a kind of interesting group of people to support. And we've been trying to get millionaires to step up and be supportive of raising taxes on themselves. And finally, just a couple resources. Inequality.org is a web portal, and a little weekly newsletter we put out called Too Much that you can sign up for at that website. You know, when I think people are asked, why have these inequalities grown in this last period? There's really no simple one explanation. I've heard it often described as that the rules of the economy have been changed to benefit asset owners at the expense of wage earners. And if you think about what are the rules of the economy, there are rules like the minimum wage, the right to organize in a union, to bargain for higher wages, tax policy, trade policy. There's a whole kind of universe of rules. And the rules after World War II were organized to focus on expanding the middle class. And the rules of the last 30 years has been about boosting stock prices and increasing, you know, cutting capital gains so that wealth funnels to the top. And that's why we want somebody who's actually involved in writing the rules to speak to us, because I think that sometimes we think about these inequalities almost like they're acts of nature or weather, that these trends are beyond human control, when in fact they're very much rooted in the political system that we have. The rules used to be organized so that we grew together. The rules have shifted so that now we're pulling apart. So one of the most important people thinking about this is our next speaker, Representative Jan Schakowsky. She has represented the 9th District from Chicago. You have a constituent in the room? All right, good. And prior to that, she served in the Illinois State Legislature. Prior to that, she was a tireless organizer, community advocate on consumer protection issues. In her leadership role in Congress, she served on the National Commission on Fiscal Responsibility and Reform, sometimes called the Deficit Commission. She was sort of, I think, our champion and maverick there, putting forward bold proposals that would not mess around with Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid, but would actually address the deficit through progressive revenue and targeted spending cuts in the military and other. So she brought forward the progressive deficit reduction alternative, really, and to help that conversation. She is really an advocate for working families, always has been. She serves on the Energy and Commerce Committee. She really thinks about these issues of inequality and what's happening to the middle class. She's introduced a number of pieces of important legislation related to jobs, the right to organize, and a piece of legislation dear to my heart called the Fairness in Taxation Act, which would add some new top tax rates on incomes over $1 million. So please welcome Representative Jan Schakowsky.
Thank you for that really nice introduction, Chuck. I'm so glad to be here. Day three for me. I'm really happy to see all of you as well. I rely very much on organizations like IPS, the Institute for Women's Policy Research, EPI, Economic Policy Institute. Megan Michaud, who's here, does the work in our office, helps mobilize the resources of all these progressive organizations, CAP, and the Campaign for America's Future, CAF. So I want to thank all of those of you who work in those kinds of organizations, the Wealth for the Common Good. Chuck, thank you for helping me. Thank you. It's Patriotic Millionaires. Is that what it? Yeah, for helping get rich people to support my tax bill. I wanted to say that because I think this inside-outside partnership that progressives can develop is so important. And the more we get real-time information, the more we can put it into the conversation, amplify your voice, you can amplify our voice. So I wanted to say that. This is my favorite chart. I actually had it laminated so it wouldn't, you know, I could take it anywhere and then blown up and, you know. So I like it because even at the back of a room, people can get the idea just by looking at it. And this is the growth in income between 1979 and 2005. So the disparities would be even more extreme now if we took it up to 2011. But what you see is that the top 0.1%, the red zone, they increased their income during that period by an average of almost $6 million a year. And if you look at the bottom fifth, so that's 20% of the population, they saw their income grow about $200, second, fourth, not about $10,000. You see, I think it's really a very clear representation of this concentration of wealth. And of course, that $6 million, keep in mind, is just the growth in their income. And we've heard a lot of numbers, but let me just repeat a couple. The top 1% of Americans have more wealth than the bottom 90%. And the average income of the bottom 90%, now we're talking average, not median. You know, I think, Chuck, in the chart you showed, the median income of white men is really skewed. Mm-hmm. That middle, median is in the middle. Because all of the really rich guys at the top skew it way up. Because the average income is slightly less than $33,000 a year for 90% of Americans. So look at that amazing disparity. The richest 400, just 400 Americans have as much wealth as the bottom 150 million Americans combined. And the average CEO, the Fortune 500 CEO, makes more money before lunch on the first working day of the year than his minimum wage worker makes all year. So right around coffee break time, that CEO has made as much money as his minimum wage worker. There was a Washington Post article earlier this week that how the president of Amgen, that's a large biotech firm, was given a raise from $15 million to $21 million earlier this year, despite the fact that their shareholders have lost money over the last 5 years. And Amgen has been closing plants and cutting its workforce by 2,700 workers, or more than 13%. And so for all of this wonderful achievement and success, Kevin Scherer, Amgen's president, got a 37% larger salary. In the article, it talked about how that the reason for that is they wanted to target his salary at about 75% of the average CEO salary, so they could hang on to a guy that was doing as well as he was. You know, really, they're not as smart as we think, or they think, not we think, but they think. We were talking about some of the things that work and some that we think don't work. First of all, it is so frustrating to me that there still are, in sort of normal conversation, reported on the news, they repeat it over and over again, that the trickle-down works. I mean, how many times do we have to look at the facts to know that absolutely it doesn't, and that the job creators are not the rich guy? If that were true, where are the jobs? I mean, it's prima facie evidence. The big corporations are sitting on $2 trillion worth of wealth. We see that the top has, those so-called job creators have plenty of money, and they're not creating the jobs. The notion of class warfare, I don't know if I can do this. I was actually going to try, and Elizabeth Warren, who you just heard in the plenary, if you haven't heard her, I don't know if my BlackBerry can do this, but if you haven't heard her description of why rich people need to contribute more to our society, look up Elizabeth Warren, a video of hers where she talked about how every single person depends on the federal government. No question about it. Let's see if I can get it here. Yeah, oh, you're going to work out. Okay, let's see. I was able to get the sound, I thought. But if you can do that, okay, work on that. Thank you, Chuck. It's absolutely worth seeing. So Heidi mentioned some of the things that we need to do. If you were to overlay on my chart with income going up, union participation, you would see it going in absolutely the other direction. And this, again, is absolutely no accident. It is policy that has made it harder for unions to organize, more leeway for corporations to hire union-busting firms, and whether they do it legally or illegally, they do it. If you are a union member, your wages are almost 28% higher than non-union members. Oh, this is so good. Is that?
It's just her quote.
Oh, it's just her quote. Let's look at it, though. I want to memorize it. Seriously, we should all memorize this. There's nobody in this country who got rich on his own. Nobody. You built a factory out there, good for you. But I want to be clear. You moved your goods to market on the roads the rest of us paid for. You hired workers, the rest of us paid to educate. You were safe in your factory because of police forces and fire forces that the rest of us paid for. You didn't have to worry that marauding bands would come and seize everything at your factory. Now look. You built a factory, turned into something terrific or a great idea, God bless. Keep a big hunk of it. But part of the underlying social contract is you take a hunk of that and pay forward for the next kid who comes along. Isn't that just awesome? I'm going to memorize every single word of that. I'm just going to run quickly through, and we can talk about them later. Raising the minimum wage, of course. We need to have equality in education. The disparity of Black and Latino students from white students in math and science proficiency, distressingly large. The rising cost of a college education, squeezing millions of students and families. Either they can't go, they end up with tremendous debt, and it's unattainable for too many Americans. So we're going to have to assure that our students can compete, that they can do it. Years after Brown versus the Board of Education, we see such tremendous disparities. And you see that, of course, reflected then in these income disparities as well. We have a shortage of qualified and effective math and science teachers. The heart of it is teachers who are under tremendous siege and criticized. And what we need is to honor and pay our teachers. I was shocked by Heidi's figure that the reason Asian women do better, because they don't go into teaching. Think of that. High-quality early education. So we have to also do really good vocational education. So we're preparing young people who don't go to college for advanced manufacturing and the real jobs of the future. We need to invest in school modernization. Thankfully, the president's bill includes that. Let me just one little vignette. It sounds like I'm bragging. I am. So the president called me about, I think it was a week ago Thursday. I had been trying to reach him about Medicare or some other things. But I started out congratulating him on the jobs bill that he had. And he said, well, thank you, because we borrowed liberally from the Schakowsky bill. The reason I tell you that is that we can, as progressives, change the conversation, even if we can't pass word for word the legislation we have. So the more we push and pull, the more we're able to get done. So the school modernization of the existing 80,000 schools, at least one-third are in need of extensive repair or replacement. Two-thirds have troublesome environmental conditions. We're talking about asbestos or lead and water and paint. The average public school building, 42 years old, not designed to meet current technology, and so that you often can't get computers. We have to address the digital divide. My grandchildren have, I don't know, iPhones, iPads, everything. And so they're just more able to. I think every kid, though, if they had that equipment, could get it in an instant. I mean, the lack of hesitation for technology is just incredible to me. But anyway, they speak it as a native language, and we at best do stumble along as a foreign language, you know? Or me, I'm talking about myself. The tax system, of course. So my Fairness in Taxation Act, it actually came about after I read this article that 81% of Americans think the best way out of our deficit and debt problem is to tax millionaires and billionaires. On all of our issues, we have the high political ground. This is what people want. This is what they believe. This isn't class warfare. This is what the majority. And so I introduced a bill that, Megan worked long and hard, Chuck contributed, that said the people who earn $1 million a year will pay now at a 45% tax rate, ratcheting up if you're a billionaire and people make $1 billion a year. A guy named John Paulson, who's a hedge fund manager, $5 billion last year, and he pays at about 15% rate because he's a hedge fund manager. Crazy rules. Anyway, so they would pay at 49%, which is still lower than the high tax rate under the Ronald Reagan administration. And so he was my benchmark, Ronald Reagan. It would generate close to $1 trillion over the next 10 years in a fair way. And I absolutely will not accept this idea of a class warfare, and I think we have to be unequivocal about that. No, this isn't about revenge. This isn't about envy. This is about fairness in our country. So there are solutions. We can do this. As Chuck said, these are not natural disasters, acts of God. We can do it, and we should without. And they think of the crazy ideas they stand up and defend every day of the week. Nuts things, you know, that years ago you would have recommended therapy. It's just incredible. And so we have to be as bold about our sensible and science-based, as you saw from Heidi's charts, ideas. Thank you. Sorry.
Great. We have some time for a couple questions. So maybe we could hear maybe three questions, and then people can respond. So if you would start and say your name, introduce yourself. Yeah.
Heidi is better than the alternative. They have embraced Walmart across the board. They are the largest retail employer in the world. They employ 1.4 million associates and do not allow them to collect a bargain. And we have an administration that does public events with them every other month talking about how great they are. That is just an example of the attitude of this current administration. I would love to hear ideas from Congresswoman and Heidi and Chuck about how do we as a labor movement respond to that.
Jan, how do you want to?
I don't know enough about. I mean, the antitrust laws still exist. We would never know it. I can't respond intelligently to that question. $25,000 Rolexes, and we see, you know, all these luxury items that are selling well. The other thing, though, that they're spending their money on, the people who live in my red zone, they're not putting it under the mattress. They are also spending it on television to challenge our candidates and to spread the lies. And so in the title of this event about, you know, bad for democracy, too, it really is. This is a very dangerous element. After the Citizens United court decision that says that essentially corporations are people when it comes to their First Amendment rights, and you can do those ads. You can't directly contribute to a candidate, but you can advertise all you want. Since there are no rules about having to tell the truth in those ads, they were very heavily involved in Wisconsin in the recall races. They don't miss one. The other thing that they do is they get involved in judge races, you know, and when those low-profile races have tons of money thrown at them, we could have the judiciary controlled by the right wing because people don't pay as much attention to those races. Of course, they'll be involved in the big ones too, all of it, because there's unlimited funds. I mean, all of what we've been talking about is just all this huge transfer of wealth to them. They've just, you know, got it all, and they can spend unlimited amounts of money. This is a huge challenge for us. We have to be so much stronger and tougher. We have to do what we do best, better and better, which is field, people power, as well as harness some of the patriotic millionaires who are willing to help us to push back.
Let me just comment on the Walmart thing. If Elizabeth Warren's quote were specifically about Walmart, it would probably be, and we pay for the food stamps and the Medicaid that support your workers. Whenever there are low-wage workers, we are paying for that. And something like 40 million Americans are getting food stamps now. I mean, obviously it's worse because of the recession, but even in good times, we have a tremendous number of low-wage workers collecting food stamps. Other countries don't have that. They have higher minimum wages. As I said, Australia is at $14 an hour right now. So there's a lot we could do. I'd love to actually do some research, and I think we could show that as for communities where the big box store is like the big employer, we could show how much the food stamps and Medicaid in that area are due to Walmart workers. So I think there are some things we could get at that people kind of know, but, you know, if they could see the facts community by community, I think it would make a difference.
There's one connection between two of the questions I just wanted to make, which is about the high-end retail market, the $25,000 watches in Walmart. One thing that is I find useful to point out to friends and family is the commercial market reflects the inequalities we're living in. So you have this very high-end, you know, it's called the bifurcated Tiffany versus Walmart market.
Actually, it's now even dollar stores. Walmart is feeling the pinch a bit.
So there's sort of like the stores that served the middle class have either had to remake themselves, either as high-end or low-end. You sort of see this interesting dynamic. So it's just it's a reflection of the extreme inequalities. We have a couple more minutes for questions. Let's hear two more really quickly.
That guy back there.
Oh, sorry.
The guy who had the question a long time ago.
Okay, yes. Thank you.
I think we really need to focus on a strong vision and message. And I think the Progressive Caucus can be the leader. I know my Congresswoman Hendry, her name, would be in step with a concise, clear language change coming from the Progressive Caucus leadership. And then, you know, you folks would be the broadcast of the message to the campaign. And, you know, you would be the Grover Norquist entity for the rest of our progressive movement. You have 120, or how many, 90?
It's 140-something. I mean, we're clearly the largest subgroup of the, I mean, it's over 100. I don't remember, but at least on paper. You know, what Will Rogers said, right? You know, I'm going to Democrat. We're not great at repeating the same message, but I want to tell you, we are all on the jobs page now. And I really do think that, you know, while there may be different phrases around it, but jobs. And I think that is helping us. I think it's helping the president. I think it's helping Democrats. They're talking, you know, they're still talking cuts and debt and all that. And even Tea Partiers think that jobs are more important than dealing with the debt and deficit right now. So I think we are on the high ground, and I think that over the last month or so that there has been this change where we're all very much focused on jobs. We're getting better.
What do you see as the prospects for passage of your legislation and also for any part of President Obama's?
Well, Harry Reid now is talking about, what is it, a 5% millionaire surtax. So again, that, you know, when I introduced our bill, Chuck, it was sort of, really? You know, I mean, MSNBC covered it, God bless them. But, you know, so now there's a lot more talk about it. Harry Reid has done that. I'll be happy if we could do something like that. The jobs bill, we need to encourage the president to stick with the whole thing, not just the tax cut pieces, but the actual job creation piece, because without it, we're not going to see any effect, much of an effect, on the unemployment rate or the, you know, really jump-starting the economy. I think that's the effort right now, is to make sure that includes the jobs piece. It's small. My bill is small, 2.2 million jobs created, although that would help to spin off many, many others. I think it totally depends, actually, on you in the broadest sense. You know, if people are fed up enough with this obstructionism, with this this sick obsession with cuts and debt reduction, that maybe they'll see peril in their position and want to do something real before the next election, instead of betting against the economy in every single way right now in order to get Barack Obama. But it's tricky for them if they look like they're trying to bring everybody down. We have to organize.
I think that's an excellent closing point. And Representative Schakowsky has shown how important it is to introduce legislation, organize around it, and look, lo and behold, it ends up in a president's bill. It ends up shaping the debate. And I think that's an example of, on all these inequality issues, sort of the program we want to put forward. Let's thank our speakers, Representative Schakowsky, Heidi Hartman. Thank you. And I remind you of some resources online if you want to find more information, data, and the like. And see you out there at the picket. Thanks.
I will not stand by and just watch. I will not do it. So take me to jail right now, because I will not, after all that my parents gave me, I can't do one thing for them and tell them that I would rather die than be quiet and watch everything that they worked for go away.
When all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual.
I'm not moving. I'm not moving. And I'm not moving. I'm a law student at George Washington University, and I'm not moving. I will go to jail tonight because it's not right.
This is like a fundamental right, freedom of assembly. Like, I mean, you could put up bylaws, but that doesn't change a charter of rights.
The time has come to remove your tents, structures, equipment, and personal belongings from the park.
This is not going to be the end of the discontent amongst the people. You know, even if they come in here and clean out this park and tear all the tents out, that doesn't mean that the problems in society have disappeared. There's some major, major problems with Canadian society.
One song of yours that
he's here to
find
this park,
woman?
He's not here to do any.
Restless. Trasong, restless.
There's a kind of a restless feeling, and it pulls me from within. It sets my senses reeling, and my wheels begin to spin. In the quietude of winter, you can hear the wild geese cry. I will always love that sound until the day I die. There's a plain and a simple answer to each and every quest. From every quiet dancer who might be a special guest. In a movie made for TV or a late night interview, you might even find them on the young and the restless too. Do you get that restless feeling when you hear a whistle blast like an echo from the past of an old engine flying down a road that's uncast? The The lake is blue, the sky is gray, the leaves have turned to gold. The wild goose will be on her way, the weather's much too cold. Well, the muskie and the yore trout too have all gone down to rest. We will be returning to the things that we love best. Do you get that restless dream when you think about your dad and the scrimshaw that he had of an old schooner roving beneath the sky that's ironclad? There's a kind of a restless feeling, and it catches you off guard as we gaze off in the distance through the trees in my backyard. I can feel the restless yearning of those geese as off they roam and trade that for a warm bed in a place I can call home. Will you get that restless yearning when you hear the wicked blast of a specter from...
I'm going to finish this week's show with a clip from the Occupy Hamilton group who marched on the banks November 12th, just before they advanced inside the foyer to make their needs known.
We put up $75 billion to buy up iffy mortgages from our five big banks through the Canadian Mortgage and Housing Corporation, essentially wiping the balance clean of the banks. The government then created a $200 billion fund for the banks to borrow from. But where did they get the money for this? Well, they borrowed it from the bank to loan back to the banks. This fund is called the Emergency Financing Framework. This name implies that our impeccably sound banks might actually face an emergency from which they would need a bailout. If our Canadian banks are such paragons of virtue and prudent behavior, then why did our federal government have to relieve them of $75 billion worth of iffy mortgages? One of the reasons that Canadians, international commentators, and finance ministers and global institutions buy into this myth that our Canadian banks are safe is the fact that these and other measures, which are considered off the books, are non-budgetary. They do not appear in the expenditures. They only appear on the Canadian Mortgage and Housing Corp of Canada. This slick shell game moves have increased the government's borrowing from $13.6 billion to over $89 billion in just 3 short years. The government fought all this by stating they were merely acquiring assets taxpayer was obligated to insure if debtors failed to pay up. The government failed to mention that the taxpayers are only obligated to insure these assets because the government forced the taxpayers to insure them. The amount of risk from which Canadians freed the banks is enormous, including the additional burden of mortgages insured by the Canadian Mortgage and Housing Corporation. By the end of 2010, reached $500 billion. That's $500 billion destined for our national debt. Meanwhile, the same banks have dramatically increased the salaries of the same CEOs that took on these iffy mortgages. These CEOs have seen pay increases from 28% to 50%. When's the last time any of us got a raise like that? Especially if we're doing a bad job. These astronomical salaries of about $10 million annually for these CEOs are ridiculously disproportionate to the contributions that these same CEOs make to our society. As a bonus, the current Canadian system enables these corporations to allow this to happen, as well as provide them with ridiculously low corporate tax rates. Corporate tax rates have steadily decreased from 40% to 15%, and possibly even lower after 2012. That 15% is one of the lowest rates in the entire developed world. What is to be learned here then? Clear the bank books using kleptonomics, increase our national debt, saddle the citizens with taxpayer debt from your financial and political shell games, and you will be rewarded with a job with a huge salary, extremely low taxes to pay, if any are paid at all, as all the five big banks have done, dodging over $16 billion worth of taxes between 1993 and 2007 alone. We march today to say that we are on to the government and our banks and the shell games that they play with their kleptonomics while we pay. We march today to put an end to these kleptonomics. We march today to say that we do not buy into the safe banks and no bailout lie anymore. We march today to put an end to the corruption within our political and banking systems. And we march today to say to the banks, pay your taxes you owe and quit asking Canadians to pay for your play.
This has been The Other Side of the News, and thanks for listening.
Redefining Radio.
CFM.